All right, friends, we are going to spend about 20 minutes in breakout rooms of three or four, depending on how the algorithm assigns you here. And so again, you're going to need to accept this invitation, and you'll be in that group for about 20 minutes. And after that, I will send you all a little message and call you back. And if you don't opt to come back, it'll automatically, about after 60 seconds, send you back into the main room for some follow-up with David. And then we'll close our morning together. So we hope that these conversations are respectful and that we speak using I statements. And this is not a time for fixing or saving, but it is a time to be with one another in mutual love and transformation as we share the responses to these invitations from David. So have a good time, and we'll see you back in about 20 minutes. So this time is for us to spend some time dialoguing with David. And so if you have any questions or comments you'd like for him to respond to, you're welcome to type those in the chat. You can find the chat by clicking the chat button on your, if you have a desktop or a laptop computer, it should be right there at the bottom of the screen. Or if you're on a mobile device or a smart device or a tablet device, you are probably going to have to click a link of options or settings in order to open it up to click chat to see. But that's one way to do it. The other way to do it would be to click participants and raise hand. There's a raise hand button that'll digitally raise a hand that I can see if you'd like to say something. Or if there's a lull in the conversation, you're welcome to try to unmute and do that as well. So there's a few ways to do that, but we've got about 15 minutes or so to dialogue with David, and so feel free to offer up some comments or questions. I think I saw a hand here. Anne, is it?
Yeah, Anna.
Anna, good to see you.
David, I was particularly touched by your description of the Black music, and I've heard all those songs often, and I grew up with Southern gospel and Black music and the church and all that. But I was really interested in your comment that much of it is in code. And I think that really gave me an insight to pay more attention to the words. And I'm wondering if your music now, your continuation of that, is still in code, you know, in your churches and how you're doing your music now. I'm wondering if you still feel that way.
For the most part, the only way that it's in code now is when we reenact the experience and use the words, use the terms from generations past. But for the most part, the composers of the present era are pretty bold, with one caveat. Many of them have, in our system of capitalism, have surrendered their consciousness and conviction that makes Black music what it is. So in some ways, it's more entertaining in some cases. And because of that, not just because of that, but it's one of the motivators behind the growth of hip hop music, because where the church fails, these younger Black voices just really want to get the truth out.
Thanks, David. There's another question here in the chat from Reverend Dr. Yoshitomi. It says, hello, David. What are your thoughts about the Catholic Black Church and its music and liturgy?
Well, I can't say much to that because my exposure to it is limited. However, for my part, what I have seen and experienced, it contributes to the rise of hip hop as well. Anytime there is a blending of Westernism with Black culture, Black culture loses something. It loses something of its conviction and consciousness.
Thank you. There's another comment in the chat here from Molly Kellogg that says, thank you, David, for such important and valuable information and history. I wonder to what extent the Black community has reflected on the loss of the music of their ethnic origins. This is perhaps a contrast to the Native American community, which retains to a degree the connection to the music of their historic ethnic origins.
Yeah, if I understand that, it's what I was seeking to communicate when I said that we are recovering our music and our history. There's an intentionality about it, especially in the academy, and even more especially in the divinity schools, the seminaries that are historically Black. You know, whether it's Howard University, you know, or Morehouse and Spelman, these are places where there's an intentionality of recovering our history. And to be quite frank, those are places where it was conserved. Those are places where it has been kept alive in the choral performances, studies, things like that. And yet, but the appreciation for it and the study of it, I think, is growing.
Oh, I see Mary Becker's got a hand up over here.
So sticking with the music, I don't think this is off the point. In my small group, Joe asked me, I used to spend a fair amount of time in Haiti, the country of Haiti. And he said, so what was the Haitian music like? And it was, I hadn't ever thought about it, but it was very similar to the gospel and singing in the United States. And he said, but people in the United States were enslaved, and you know, it came out of that. But I said, really, poverty is the oppression there, and it comes out of that same sense, and it has the same kind of empowering feel to it. A lot of movement, a lot of repetition, clapping. It's used, I didn't hear it in churches, but I heard it in solidarity groups there. It's beautiful. Thank you for your work and your words.
Yes, Mary, that is spot on. It's true in Haiti, and it's true throughout Pan-Africa. Afro-Brazilians are there. I've heard when visiting there some of the finest Black gospel music. So it is an expression of solidarity.
Marianne.
I would like to.
There you go, Marianne.
Okay. I was particularly touched with your notion of the moral authority of oppressed people. I just really resonated with me in terms of that connection with Jesus and suffering. And then you brought in Bill W. And the notion that we have to go into our pain and our suffering in order to come out on the other end is changed. And I just am wondering how music is so powerful to do that. I just, you know, maybe you could speak a little bit more to that notion, and we're watching it with Stacey Abrams having a voice. Is there more you could say about that?
Well, first of all, I have to say you must have quite a Wi-Fi signal to be coming in from outer space there.
No, I don't know what happened to my, but I am the cosmos.
Awesome. The moral authority is because we have to deal with reality. We can't live in illusions. And it's not something we can turn on and off very easily. Some people of color have, they've turned it off. And they have completely surrendered to whiteness. They have, you know, they've basically accommodated despair. They see no hope for resurrection and redemption. And so for all intents and purposes, they become white people in Black skin or brown skin. There's a lot of that going on right now, especially in the Hispanic community. well, let me take that back. In the Hispanic evangelical community, there's a lot of selling out, but there's some in, you know, in the Black community as well. And so there is an abandonment of moral authority. Things you know are true. Things you know are right. A great example of this, I think a historic example of this is Clarence Thomas, who with his Harvard Law colleagues studied civil rights law, but he got a good paying job for a Republican senator and just abandoned everything and wrote a letter to his colleagues at Harvard saying, the sky is the limit in the Republican Party for Black people. And so he has abandoned all moral authority and has no influence whatsoever in Black America. You know, there's just no regard for him. So it's so the estimation of Clarence Thomas is so low that if you go to the National Museum of African American History and Culture at the Smithsonian, there is no mention of Clarence Thomas. I mean, they've already got Colin Kaepernick in there. So it kind of shows you that that moral authority goes only with those who are fellow sufferers.
Could we go back to the music for a minute? I just wanted to talk about my original experience with spirituals. I cannot really remember how I've always loved to sing. I can't remember how I first was introduced to them, certainly not in our very white Episcopalian conventional church in the suburbs of Chicago. Maybe it was in school, but they so appealed to me that I memorized all the words. But the music and the sound of the longing that came through those words struck me deeply. Not only the suffering, but out of the suffering was the hope in the background. And that was Jesus. And they were my church. And I grew up singing as I became older and had children. When I sang them to sleep at night, they were always the spirituals. And they sort of rocked us to sleep together, all of us, with that beautiful, aching, moaning, a sheer beauty of the longing that you knew that someday it would all come true. There was so much truth in it, that it was real. I've not felt that reality in any of our usual heavy Victorian hymns that we sing most of the time. Certainly, stand up for Jesus and all the warlike type things, the gentleness of them and the almost the willing to wait. It will come. It will come. Yeah. Just keep your eyes on Jesus. It's so simple. It's so real.
Yeah. As you say that, I think of the fact that there's that Black supremacy is not a thing. Nobody's contending for that. You know, it's all about equality. This is where moral authority is a factor again, because our fight is never for supremacy or domination.
Thank you. We've got about time for one more. I see a hand up. Mike Conlon is going to share with us.
Yeah, this is a great irony that I have, both in reading Dr. Thurman and, you know, following Martin Luther King and even in the Negro spirituals today, that African-Americans are brought over to the United States. They lose family, they lose history, they lose their name, and they lose whatever religion that they had in Africa. And the irony is the salvation is in a religion given to them by their oppressors. And I it's a strange thought process that you're finding salvation by taking what the oppressor has given you or foisted upon you, mostly to subjugate, I imagine, and try and keep you down. But is there any, there's no such longing for the previous religions of Africa, or is that the only benefit of slavery, et cetera, is finding Jesus and Christianity in the United States? Is a perplexing problem.
So were you asking me something there?
Do you find it ironic that Jesus is a salvation for the African-American situation in the past and the present, but it's also a religion that was not known to to slaves, et cetera, when they're prior to coming over.
Yeah, you know, I'm not surprised that Jesus provides salvation, is seen as the savior for African-Americans. I'm amazed that Jesus is seen as a savior for white people.
Touché.
Save us from ourselves.
Well, maybe we can, unless you have a follow-up, maybe we can let that one hang for this morning and have Pat.
Tim, let me just mention this, that in in the Black Academy, they no longer have, well, for the most part, no longer have conferences around Black Christianity, but around Black religions.
We'll hold that. That's a powerful contrast to this morning's conversation as well. So, Pat, if you want to pop in here and unmute and lead us home, we'll be ready to go.
Okay. Well, what a morning you've given us, David. Thank you for this particular entry, this particular frame, showing us how African-American music literally carried the secrets of Black life and morality, and how their experience of continuous resilience in the face of oppression offers a model for this dominant culture that's melting down in chaos. Much to think about, and there could not be a more whole start, I think, forward for us. Thank you for everything that you brought us this morning. Next
Pat, may I make one more remark?
Please.
Thank you. I just want to say that everything that we've talked about today it's very local and immediate as well. In Santa Barbara, of the historic Black churches, Greater Hope Baptist Church, Lewis Chapel, Friendship Baptist Church, St. Paul, AME, all of these churches, well, one of them no longer exists. Second Baptist is gone. That was led by the great Leander Wilkes. That church is gone, but only Reverend Ficklin actually lives here. The other pastors, because of gentrification and economics, they all commute here from North County or from Ventura County. And I can't tell you how many days in the past that I have awakened wondering if I could still be in Santa Barbara. Things are starting to smooth out a little bit, but for years I wondered if I would have to be one of those commuters or just relocate completely. This is the state of the Black church in Santa Barbara, and I think it deserves our attention.
Thank you, David. That is on the table as well. And I believe that we'll probably be coming back to some of this as we move through the rest of our weeks together. Next week, we get to meet the author of our other source book, Ibram X. Kendi, when Anne and Tom Heck bring us a carefully curated set of videos that will get us acquainted with the man himself, beyond his words on the pages that we'll be reading in the chapters of his book. If David has set the music and tone for our journey, Anne and Tom will bring you some more of the words for it from our author for the next 8 weeks, Ibram X. Kendi. So we hope you'll join us next Thursday, January 21st at 10 a.m. for another powerful morning in Confronting Racism. Stay safe and have a good week.
Thank you, David.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Thank you, David.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll see you all next week.
We might mention this has been recorded if you want to listen again.
Yes, it'll be posted soon, I'm sure, to the website. We'll see you all next Thursday.